Hey, Leading Learning listener, if improving as a learning business professional is one of your goals for 2026, make sure to go to leadinglearning.com/summit.
The Learning Business Summit is the only event laser-focused on professionals who lead and work in market-facing businesses that serve adult learners. Across 3 days online, you'll connect with peers and experts to strengthen both your knowledge and your network.
Featuring hands-on practitioners and subject matter experts, the live education sessions are designed for participation, reflection, and, most importantly, action to boost the reach, revenue, and impact of your learning business.
And because leveraging technology is essential for any learning business, the summit also includes demos of LearnTech platforms.
It all happens online January 27th, 28th, and 29th. Go to leadinglearning.com/summit to get all the details and join us for the Learning Business Summit.
Now, on with the episode.
If you're a leader or an aspiring leader in the business of lifelong learning, you're in the right place. I'm Salisa Steele.
And I'm Jeff Cobb, and this is the Leading Learning Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to episode 125 of the Leading Learning Podcast. In this episode, we talk with Kathy Moore. For many of our listeners, Kathy will need no introduction. She is well known across the learning world as a writer, speaker, and training designer who is out to save the world from boring instruction. We're going to help her save the world one podcast listener at a time. But before we do that, we want to acknowledge our sponsor for the first quarter of 2018.
We are happy to have Blue Sky eLearn sponsoring this quarter. Blue Sky eLearn is the maker of the Path Learning Management System, an award-winning cloud-based learning solution that empowers your organization to maximize its message. Blue Sky eLearn also provides a range of virtual event and instructional services to help you maximize your content and create deeper engagement with your audience. To find out more about Blue Sky eLearn and everything it has to offer, visit blueskyelearn.com.
For our resource for this episode, we want to point you to a collection of resources that Kathy Moore has on her site for what she calls action mapping. You'll be hearing more about action mapping in the interview, but the high level is that Kathy created this to help you analyze a performance problem and design solutions that work. This is really valuable stuff to have handy when your learning business launches into creating new offerings, and you can get it simply by visiting the show notes for this episode at leadinglearning.com/episode125. Now, Salisa, you and I have both been following Kathy's writing for many years now, and she often comes up in conversations that we have with folks in the leading learning world. But this is a first chance to actually talk with her in person, or at least by audio, I guess. So can you give us a preview of what the conversation was like?
Well, as you mentioned, we definitely talked about action mapping, what it is and how you can use it. We also got into measurement and evaluation, those topics that are perennially important and perennially difficult to figure out the best way to look at the impact of learning. And we talked a lot about scenarios as well, because those often figure into developing training and learning offerings that are going to be as real and relatable to the real world experience of our learners as possible. And I will say too that I think Kathy has one of my favorite answers so far to what's been one of her most significant learning experiences since leaving kind of official college education. I really liked what she had to say there.
Well, I haven't heard that answer yet. I'm looking forward to hearing it. And I know that Kathy just always just has very useful, very actionable, very valuable things to say. And I know that this interview is going to be no exception to that. So without further ado, let's roll the interview with Kathy Moore.
Hello out there. I'm Salisa Steele, and this is the Leading Learning Podcast. And today I'm very excited to be talking with Kathy Moore. Kathy is an internationally recognized training designer dedicated to, in her words, saving the world from boring instruction. She's also a speaker and an author. She writes a fantastic blog with a wealth of tools and tips and inspiration. She's written the book Map It, the hands-on guide to strategic training design. And last but not least, she's the creator of the action mapping model of training design, which is the focus of her book Map It. Kathy, welcome to the Leading Learning Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
And so to start us off, I want to give you the chance to add to that brief introduction I just gave. What else would you like us to know about yourself and your work?
I started out in K-12 e-learning in the U.S. and then switched into designing custom courses for the corporate world. And now I help instructional designers improve their skills, focusing on the business and nonprofit world.
Well, great. And so I know that, I mentioned it in the introduction that action mapping is one of the things that you're really well known for. And I'm hoping that for those who might not be familiar with the model, if you could just give us a kind of a brief overview or explanation of it to start off.
Very briefly, it is a model that helps us avoid doing information dumps and create more activity-centered training. So it starts with the question, what measurable improvement do we want to see in the organization as a result of this training? So in the case of an association, for example, it would be what measurable improvement do our learners want to see in the performance of their organization or in their personal lives, whatever we're addressing. And when we start with that, we then list what it is that people need to actually do on the job to achieve this change. So we're avoiding jumping immediately to what they need to know, and instead we're listing what do they need to do and asking what makes it hard to do. Maybe they just need some additional resources. Maybe they just need a handy reference. Maybe they don't need training. But for some of the things, if they do need training, such as practicing doing the thing in a safe place, then we design practice activities, not information presentations, but practice activities. And in those activities, we link or provide optionally the information that they might need. And then the result is some very activity-focused experience, and the learners have the freedom to pull as much information as they need, rather than everybody having to sit through the same information presentation.
Well, I know one of the things that you've said is, it's not a presentation occasionally interrupted by an activity. This really is where the activities are the focus.
Exactly.
And so, the way that you lay out the action mapping model really strikes me as hard to argue with. It just makes a lot of sense. Training may not always be the answer, but when it is, really focusing on kind of those real world activities and examples and allowing learners to draw on information as they need it to try and accomplish a goal that's hopefully mirrors as closely as possible what they have to deal with at work. All that said, again, it makes complete sense to me, but it also seems like there's room for growth in applying the model. Why aren't action mapping and practice activities more the norm? Is it just kind of a lack of knowledge that we just have to get the word out there more? Or what other barriers do you see to adoption?
I think we have sort of a cultural issue, and I rant about it for an entire chapter of my book, and that is that education, as most of us experience it, is delivery of information and then testing to see if that information has survived in the memory. And so a lot of people think that training is teaching, and therefore training should be delivery of information followed by a knowledge check. And I think also in the world of professional continuing education, that's really entrenched because we are focusing on certificates or hours of that people spend in class rather than what can they do. So it's a mindset shift, and it's a scary mindset shift because we're so familiar with the information delivery and testing model.
And so how can we begin that sort of that cultural shift? I mean, do you have some tips for in terms of how to begin to say, this is what we should be doing rather than the kind of information-focused approach or the time-based approach to fulfilling specific requirements?
It's actually easier in the corporate world for an internal training project, because we can say, look at this, we want to improve sales X%, and so we're going to have these practice activities in which our salespeople develop their skills, and look, sales have improved. So we can say, look, the practice activities worked. In the association or sort of certification world, it's a bigger risk, because the market is buying, paying for CEUs, paying for these credits. And so I would see it myself, if I were in that sector, as a differentiator. Everybody else is designing materials that present information and have you regurgitated on a test. However, we design these realistic practice activities that have you actually practice doing the thing, and maybe it's project-based and you submit a project for your credit, or the result is I can do this thing or look at this thing I created.
Well, yeah, that's great. And I like that idea of it being this differentiator. And so then it becomes part of not only how you're delivering the training opportunity, but it becomes this marketing advantage, this thing that you can use to help entice and to stand out among the other options. And so, you know, I think you've already been addressing it some, but you know, I'm just thinking that most of our listeners on the Leading Learning podcast, they often don't have that direct access to their learners, you know, as the sort of corporate training departments do, where they can kind of, you know, if needed, shadow people on their jobs or, you know, have really direct access to those learners and perhaps their supervisors and bosses. So, you know, other advice or even perhaps cautions that you might have for folks who are not dealing with corporate training, but are dealing with, you know, educating adults in that professional development, continuing education, lifelong learning space. What advice would you have for them when thinking about how they might apply the action mapping model?
This is a tough thing. A couple of things I would suggest is to view the material or view the project or the need, the market need, from the perspective of the learner and not from, hey, somebody has this idea to present this, or our competitors are presenting a course on whatever. What do the members need? And I think you have a blog post pointing out that you can't just survey them. It's an idea, but if you just survey them and ask them what they want, there can be a gap between what they say they want and what they actually buy. So there is the concept of the minimum viable product, which you guys also have mentioned, which I'm a big fan of, which is to develop a handful of activities on this topic that you think is useful for them and see how well they sell, see how well they're received. The cool thing about doing this activity-based approach is that you can create just a handful and sell them as a little package of activities. It doesn't have to be this full-blown course with a huge structure and a final assessment. You can test with a few activities. So one thing would be, okay, view it from this, get a sense of the market need. What do they want? Make sure that your subject matter expert has recently or is currently doing the job that this is supposed to help people do, and ideally have more than one subject matter expert that can answer the question, what do they need to do? And very importantly, what makes it hard? Because if you understand a little bit more what are the pressures on the job that are making it hard to do this thing, you can create realistic practice activities that not only have them practice applying knowledge, but also have them practice the more tricky stuff like responding to a customer, responding to a client with a complex situation. Because we can boil things down into bullet points on what you should or shouldn't do and deliver that on one slide, have a test and be done. But that does not necessarily change what anybody can do on the job. They need to practice it in, for example, a branching scenario, which is a practice in a safe place. So I've lost my point, but the main point is to view it from the perspective of the learners. Make sure your SMEs understand the challenges that the learners face. Consider producing a minimum viable product of a handful of activities that help people practice this thing. Test them on the market or on some learners and go from there.
Well, I really like what you're saying, because I do think that this is a way to, as you were saying, this involves or might involve a culture shift, this type of approach to learning. And so this idea of the minimum viable product, because you can begin to build some data around whether this is resonating with the learners. You can begin to prove it out without having to invest a lot of time and money necessarily. So I think that's great advice. You know, measurement and evaluation, these are areas that we often hear about with the folks that we interact with who are in the business of lifelong learning, because they can be tough areas to tackle. You know, it can be easy to measure the insignificant dimensions, the sort of typical smile sheet, level one type reactions, and it can be all too easy to neglect the impact of learning. But I'm thinking, since action mapping ties any learning or training intervention really tightly to results, I'm thinking that it would be really helpful in measurement and evaluation of those learning interventions. And so I would just love to get your thoughts on how best to measure and evaluate the impact of learning.
Again, it's easier in a sort of sealed corporate world than it is in the association world, because a corporation doing an internal learning project can measure really directly the effect. Outside of that, I guess I would, again, because we're viewing it from the perspective of the market, of the learners, they want to improve something, they want to achieve something, we identify a measure that they might actually have access to and set that as our goal. And ideally, after the learning intervention, which is more than a course, something I did not mention is that when we are activity-based and we have these standalone activities that include the optional information that's needed to do them, we can space them out over time. Mm-hmm. So you're not just sitting through a 45-minute talking head video and then getting your credit. You are maybe doing practice activities once a day for 2 weeks, which is supported by research as a better way to learn. We learn more deeply through spaced practice. So we have a measurement that the learner cares about and ideally has access to. We have them go through this thing, however long it takes. At the end of the thing, they check that measurement again, or they, whatever. It's much harder in the association world, I think, because you don't have such direct control. But I would try to make it, put it within the learner's reach. And there could even be, before you take the materials, here's a practice activity, a rather complex one, that sort of gives you a "you are here" score. How well do you manage this difficult client? And then you go through the practice activities and you do a different activity as an assessment. And it says, now you are here. So there's even a sort of a pre-test and post-test aspect that might work as well. Again, all based on what they can do, not what they know.
Mm-hmm. Great. Yeah. I like that idea of the pre-test, because that then helps make the measure of the effectiveness of the learning a little more objective, as opposed to being sort of the subjective, which can be the danger of if you're having to rely on the learner's sort of self-reporting around how they've gotten, how they've approved or not.
Yes. And that's especially true if you are like delivering credit based on improvement, because it's much harder to measure improvement in their skills on the job if you aren't there looking at them do the job. That's one reason why we keep punting to knowledge assessments, because that's so easy to score.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and so I also want to dig in a little bit to scenario design, because, you know, that's another area where you focused your work, because scenarios often are these really effective practice activities. And so will you talk a little bit about how you approach scenario design and what common mistakes or missteps you see with scenario design?
There's a lot. I've been running a scenario design course-like event thing for several years now. It's a 4-week experience in which people actually design scenarios during the length of the course, or whatever we want to call it. So I see all the mistakes, and some of the very common ones are not having a specific, clear, in-depth, super in-depth, highly contextual understanding of the task that people are supposed to practice. Mm. And again, that means you need to have subject matter experts that are there on the job and can report what makes it hard and what are the challenges people are facing. It also suggests that you create a prototype. I strongly advocate for this. You create a prototype and test it on actual learners to get their feedback on how realistic is it. But basically, you need to get not just, you know, what should they do and what's the right thing to do and what do they do wrong, but what is the correct thing to do and why is it hard to do? What is the common mistake and why is it so tempting? What are the other common mistakes and what makes them tempting? What are the consequences to each of these options? Because we're not going to just say correct or incorrect. We're going to continue this story with the logical consequence of what they have chosen, and they're going to see for themselves whether that was a good choice or not. So there's a lot more detailed, specific, contextual knowledge. And again, in the association world, we're tempted to create generic courses because we're trying to cover one thing for everyone. But we're much better off in scenario land to have a super specific example. And if that requires making up a fictional company or a fictional association or fictional whatever with a fictional challenge, that is a better result. That's a better approach than doing something abstract and generic. Because abstract and generic, the answers are always going to be really obvious.
Well, that's an interesting point. Yeah, the more grounded you are in reality and in a specific situation, the more effective the scenarios are because they model the real world more. But it does, as you're saying, I mean, it does have kind of an effect of limiting perhaps the learners to which that really applies. But again, if you do that, then there's a potential for huge return because you really are mirroring their real world, real work situation.
Exactly.
Well, so, you know, I'm thinking as we're talking here that this idea of scenario design that, and this idea of being really specific to the learner situation, I mean, it makes me think of learner personas a little bit, and that perhaps that can be an effective tool in figuring out which scenarios are going to fit by really having that sense of who are our learners and which learners are we serving with this particular scenario. Do you work with learner personas much?
I do recommend using them, and I'm also very careful to distinguish between learner persona from the perspective of marketing, which is we have a view of our learner as a person. We kind of know who they are, so we make up one learner that kind of represents them. You know, like we have learner Pat, whose husband works for the post office, and Pat works for a nonprofit that helps immigrants deal with taxes. I don't know. So we have this particular person who we are imagining as a learner. Unfortunately, in the e-learning world, some vendors are using the term persona to represent avatar, talking animated guide to the content. So I'm really careful to say what we're talking about is from the marketing perspective of understanding the learner, making up a fictional learner. And so when we're doing our design, we could say, what would Pat think about this? How would Pat respond to this, Pat, our fictional learner?
Well, I think that's a really interesting point how the term is getting perhaps misused or being applied in different ways. And so being really clear about what that means and this idea of it being this fictional representation of a real learning segment, though, that you're seeking to serve and using that as sort of shorthand for thinking about what those that particular set of your learners needs to be able to do. I was almost said what they need to know, but then I realized, no, it's what they need to be able to do. Well, great. You know, I'm thinking, you know, you've been involved, you know, as you said at the outset, you started out in K-12, you've sort of morphed over the years of your career so far. And so I'm just thinking, you know, you've had a relatively long perspective on learning and training, and you've seen it from different angles. So I'd be interested to know what's on the horizon for the design of learning. Are there any big developments or changes that you think we'll see in learning design in the coming years, or that you hope we'll see?
What I hope we'll see is less focus on delivering and testing information and more focus on designing practice activities, supporting practice in the real world, on-the-job mentoring, things like that. I'm a technology skeptic. I know that people get all excited about different technologies as they show up. So I'd rather see an interest in creating practice drive the technology that we choose. And if we go from that perspective, there are some tools like Twine, which is a tool for writing interactive fiction, Twine, T-W-I-N-E. It's free. And it's a great way to write scenarios, either mini scenarios, branching scenarios, and even produce them and develop them and deliver them. And it's free. So I get excited about technology that helps us design practice activities. I'm not so excited about lots of trends that we have. I'm pretty much immune to the trends.
Well, I like that point that we need to the technology is a tool, and we need to think about what we're using tools for. And so the focus on practice activity sort of driving that, and the rather than getting too excited by the shiny new object on the horizon. So next to last question, and this is one that we'd like to ask everyone who comes on the Leading Learning podcast. I would like to hear about one of your experiences with learning. So something that you've been involved with since leaving your formal education. What's one of the most powerful learning experiences that you've been a part of?
In the early 2000s, I wanted to design a super energy efficient passive solar house. Mm. And so I did. And that's a huge amount of learning. You have to learn how to choose the land, how to choose the orientation, what kind of trees do you want around the house, what's a good floor plan, what percentage of window space facing south to thermal mass, like concrete floor, do you need? What type of thermal mass? Do you want gallons of water spaced out in your living room like they did in the 70s, or are you going to do something a little more attractive? There's a huge number of decisions to make. And the way I learned it was getting on the internet and also checking out books from the library, but it was a project-based learning thing. I did not sign up for a course called Principles of Passive Solar Design. I thought, you know, here is my budget, here's my vision, how do I bring it about? And so every time I looked for knowledge, it was to solve a specific problem and to identify the next step I needed to do. It was extremely interesting, and I did a very common thing, which is I had a website about my house. So as I was making these decisions, I recorded it in the website saying, okay, and I chose to have these many windows because that was the optimal ratio of south-facing glass to a poured concrete floor. And I chose to do this, that, and the other thing. I chose this type of wall system over the other because of this. And so I was recording my decisions, but also sharing why I decided them with strangers on the internet. I don't have that site anymore. It's out of date, so I took it down. But it was an excellent learning experience.
Well, it seems like that falls in that camp, too, of if you want to learn something, teach it. So, you know, as you're sharing the rationale for your decisions, you're sort of trying to explain, you know, why you made the choices that you did. And it feels like you're in that teaching role at the same time when you're also learning it.
And it also, it does open you up for critique. So if you put on your site, well, I chose this wall system over this other wall system, you get emails saying, you should have chosen, you know. So it's another way to learn because you think, maybe this person's right and I chose the wrong thing. But it makes you make better decisions and prepare to defend your decisions. And that's another thing that we can do in our practice activities. Like if we're having them practice a difficult conversation, they choose something to say, rather than immediately continuing the story, we could say, why did you choose that? Mm-hmm. And have them defend their choice, which makes sure that they are, you know, engaged cognitively, they have a strategy and they're applying it and they're not just clicking stuff.
Well, right. And sometimes too, I would think that, especially in some more complex decisions, that you can often perhaps arrive at, quote, you know, a wrong or a bad decision, but perhaps your rationale actually is pretty accurate, you know, and so it could just be a way of sort of shifting them and sort of saying, well, you know, you're on the right path here with your rationale, but, you know, sort of helping.
And it also makes them improve their metacognitive skills. It makes them, reminds them to be aware of the strategy behind what they're choosing. They may be making choices based on intuition, for example, and we want to surface what is the strategy that you're applying here so that they can think about it more logically and, you know, analyze it more logically.
Yeah, that's great. Great point. Metacognition there. Excellent. Well, so final question that I have for you just is, if listeners would like to know more about your work, where should they go?
They can go to my site, Kathy-Moore.com. That's Kathy with a C, -Moore, M-O-O-R-E.com, where they will find everything, including, lots of resources on scenario design, some practice activities, examples of activities, a page about the book, a link to buy the book, some information about upcoming courses, workshops, things like that.
Yeah, and I will second what you just said. There is a wealth of information there. It's a great resource, so I really encourage listeners to check it out. And Kathy, thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you.
That wraps up our interview with Kathy Moore. To get show notes for this episode, just go to leadinglearning.com/episode125. And while you're there, you'll be able to find the link to the action mapping resources that we mentioned at the beginning of the episode.
And while you're at the show notes, you're going to also see various options for subscribing to the podcast. And if you're getting value out of what you hear, we would be truly grateful if you would subscribe.
We'd also be grateful if you take just a minute to give us a rating on iTunes. All you have to do is go to leadinglearning.com/iTunes. That'll put you in the right place. We appreciate getting those ratings and reviews because it helps us know that you value what we're doing here at Leading Learning, and it also helps others to find the podcast.
We would also be grateful if you would take a minute and visit our sponsor for this quarter, Blue Sky eLearn. Jeff and I put a lot of work into producing and delivering the Leading Learning podcast, and one of the reasons we're able to do that is because of the support of sponsors like Blue Sky eLearn. So please go check them out at blueskyelearn.com. And I'll say that in addition to finding out about their products and services, you're going to also find a variety of great resources that they offer for free.
Finally, consider telling others about the podcast. You can send out a tweet simply by going to leadinglearning.com/share, or if tweeting just isn't your thing, you can take the language there and put it into any other social network of your choice.
Thanks again, and see you next time on the Leading Learning Podcast.